Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, it's Monday. It's January 17th and cold outside, and it's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard, but the person who's going to warm us up is none other than John Bailey, the White Plains Citizen reporter, publisher, and editor. Good morning, Mr. Bailey. How are you?
Good morning from White Plains, New York, USA, Hezzy, where it's 39 and partly sunny after a Dracula night in Westchester County.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, before we got started, you had mentioned that you had read an article about Lionsgate, which is a new studio that opened up only recently, last few days, officially opened up in Yonkers. So what did you glean from the article in the New York Times?
Well, I think what this is a real real good thing for Yonkers and for Mayor Mike Spano to position himself mm-hmm. as someone who can bring in development. And I think that positions him for a run for county executive in 4 years.
Well, that's actually very, very astute, I think. I have heard that there will be more development in Northwest Yonkers. Don't have all the information, but I'm going to be going to see some people later on this week, and hopefully I'll be able to share that story with you as well. But it looks like Mayor Spano is doing a bang-up job because he's pushing forward for greater development. And if that's
right.
the case, that, just like you said, it's going to put him in a great place for higher office because it will show his capacity.
Well, it's something that no other legislator who would be a natural candidate for county executive can mm-hmm. can boast of, whereas and Yonkers has the largest population in the county, so actually,
right.
And Mike Spano will have no competition from the Republicans, and so
no.
I think that he immediately becomes the front runner if he does not screw up, but that cannot be said for his COVID management.
Well, you know, that's everybody's problem. The COVID management
yeah.
is absurd. And I don't really understand what's causing the effectiveness of government to try to get more people inoculated, number one, and also to make kits available. I don't know about you in White Plains, but we did a lousy job with the schools. We never disinfected them, which is the responsibility of the Yonkers Board of Education, Board of Trustees, and their superintendent, who messed up completely. And we wrote about it. They're not too happy about it, but that was the point. They didn't clean up. And then it seems that the kids are not required to have inoculations, which I don't understand either. Because the kids may
yes,
not be infected, but they are carriers.
Yes, they are. And that was the key point of White Plains schools opening with about a 2% infection rate right now, teachers, students, and pupils, at the midway point of the school year. So everybody reasonably happy about that, but there are more infections than last year.
Well, Superintendent Ricca at least tells you, at least your superintendent in White Plains, Mr. Ricca, at least he's telling us what the numbers are. In Yonkers, we don't have a clue.
The state is doing that. He's not doing it. The state is. You know, they have that
state
board.
Is doing it.
That, yes, the state is putting out those numbers, which you can see for any school district in the state.
I didn't realize that they did that for the school districts in the state, so maybe you could send me a link to that And then I'll be able to post it because we have never gotten a posting from the Board of Education at all. Nobody has a clue what the numbers are.
You have to see this because it'll break down the Yonkers schools on an individual basis. And
amazing. What a find. Mr. Bailey, you are the cream of the crop. So you know what's going on. It's really brilliant.
Well, what any reporter needs to do on any major media is to just pay attention to Governor Hochul's and prior to that, Governor Cuomo's briefings. Mm-hmm. But they never do because the editors have their own axes to grind. They wouldn't know a story if they saw it, you know?
Well, that's true. Well, maybe I failed as well because I was unaware of those statistics with regard to the schools. So, thank you for sharing that.
The state has corrected their two-day lag. So now we're getting the infections the day after.
Right.
Which is great. And that and Westchester had a really good week in COVID last week. We dropped infections mm-hmm. from 26,500 last week to the end of the previous week. We're down to 16,782. That's not bad.
No, it's really good. Well, that was anticipated, but I don't know if the drop is indicative of a diminution in the Omicron virus infecting people, because some places are saying, well, it didn't really happen, but maybe it happened here in New York State. But I'm just not sure. I don't want to rest on the laurels of success in 1 week, because who knows where it's going to go.
It's better than being more than 25,000, right? It's better than being more than 25,000.
Definitely.
Right. Now, that means that if infection, depending on what the hospitalizations are this week, we will see. If you get a 5.5% hospitalization rate from those who were mm-hmm. infected 2 weeks ago when we had the 26,000, which stunned everybody,
right.
You're mm-hmm. going to have 1,450 hospitalizations as of, say, this week. Now, if it's 2.5%, it's much less, 750, which is still a lot, but better. So I mean it may be, in my opinion, that the vaccinations are showing their power of limiting at least hospitalizations and preventing people from getting extra sick. So I mean, if you're not vaccinating, you are putting yourself at risk. It's hard to believe, and that people won't get vaccinated, and it's really slowing. I mean, people just aren't hustling in to get their shots, but they should.
Yeah, I never could understand why people were averse to getting inoculated. Some people trace back just not believing the man, quote unquote, whoever the man is, but just not believing medicine and not believing science. I just don't quite get it. I was, like, shocked all of a sudden there was a story over the weekend in which they said that Dr. Fauci from the CDC, he's got a net worth of about $10.5 million. So what? What does that mean? Does that mean that he's not proficient? I don't know what more he can do to try to get people to become inoculated. And then you got people, who's the doctor in the Senate? I forgot his name now. But he keeps challenging Fauci as if Fauci's wrong. And
Rand
Fauci
Paul.
Says, no, yeah, Grant, Rand Paul. So, but he says, no, he's not wrong. And that's the whole point. It's just unbelievable. this back and forth, well, this, these tales of woe. I don't get it. It's all politics. When are we going to trust
science?
Yes, and
science? Politics is killing us. I mean,
yes.
This is Martin Luther King's birthday, and I mean,
right.
To my way of thinking, I wish he would come back and go into Congress tomorrow and lecture both halls in his inimitable style and say things like, have you really examined this? Because if you eliminate these voting rights and make it more difficult to vote, then what is going to happen? People who want to vote and are tired of your bringing back these Jim Crow practices of discriminating against minorities and immigrants and people you don't like because they may not be of the power race, the white race, I mean, well, what is going to happen? Your states are going to be hurt economically because the minorities that can move out of there will. They will come to New York. They will come to Massachusetts. They will come to Rhode Island. They will come to perhaps Pennsylvania, although that state has my problems if they elect Dr. Oz. God help them. And at any rate, then they'd move to California. They'd move up to Washington. They'd move, they would move to Florida.
Absolutely. But you know what's very interesting? You bring up a very salient point, and that is, okay, we know Dr. King is not going to be returning, but he was definitely most eloquent. But whatever happened to, you know, President Barack Obama? I don't hear him promoting the fact that we should get inoculated, and he's very well respected both in the white community and black community and other people of color. Why don't we hear anything from him? Or have we heard
Martin unaware? You bring up an
excellent
point. He has been missing in action.
When
this voting rights push, I think it's now reached, is it 36 states have put these in? That's a lot of states.
I think so.
And he did not mention a thing. He did not go to any of those states saying this is wrong and you shouldn't do it. I mean, that's the least he could have done. Go to all 26, all 36. And,
well, also, you know, we have other people,
but he didn't.
For example.
Not too
I
many
don't watch,
people did.
Well,
you know.
I don't watch Oprah Winfrey because, you know, I'm working during the day. I guess she's still on every day. I'm not sure. I have no idea. I don't watch TV. But the thing is, do we hear from people of color that have prominence?
We should.
And I don't believe that we have, or maybe I'm just not hearing it. And then that means it's not that I'm obtuse to what's going on in the media or in the news cycles. But evidently, it's not very evident, and I don't know why that is. So, you know, it just doesn't make sense anymore, because more people need to be inoculated, and they're not. And, you know, the system is overburdened because the hospitals are overburdened, and the staffs are exhausted. This has been 2 years we've been doing this now. I mean, it's unbelievable.
I don't know what's going to. Are severely challenged. I mean, and they had like 2,000 hospitalized just from COVID alone, and and this is crazy. I mean, those are very important counties, and they are primarily responsible for the surge in New York City cases.
Well, you know, absolutely. But you know what's also interesting? You know, people don't wear the mask because they've already been infected and now they have the antibodies, or so they say, or so they think.
Yeah, we should, though.
But the point, We should, because it makes sense for them, but it also makes sense for the other people who they come in contact with. And that's what's very deleterious about everything that's going on. We don't explain it well, and we don't have people to say, this isn't working. And your rights as an individual doesn't permit you to impact other people because you think you're no longer infectious, but you can be a carrier, and you don't even realize it.
Yes,
so,
because
the
COVID germs get into your nasal cavity and into your mouth, and when you're breathing out they come. Right into a
but we don't seem to be very clear about that.
Yeah.
We don't seem to be clear about that. And then think about what happens at the hospitals. If you need to get surgery for something other than COVID, then guess what? You might be put on hold, and you may have to wait a month or two before you get surgery. They call it elective surgery. It may not be elective. So we are totally stressed out. And nobody seems to make a big scandal about it.
And the emergency rooms will get backed up.
Forget it.
It's already
happening.
And I'm tired of news articles masquerading as policy and analysis.
Yeah, that's
true. I analyze, I say analysis by me. Mm-hmm. And when it's basically a press release from somebody, I say from the Department of Legislators or something like that. But, I mean, the problem is...
Well, I do exactly the same thing because at the end of an article...
news articles is ridiculous.
Well, it should be noted as an opinion from whoever writes that. But I, like you, I do exactly the same thing. I don't write written by or written from. I always write the source. So the source of the information that's in the article, I designate who it is that I got it from so that people understand that I didn't write it. And then if I write it, then I put my name to it. Not everybody abides by these standards. They're very old. You know, I'm old. So these are things that I grew up with. It was understood. It was part of the credibility.
This grew out of the New York Magazine school of reporting back in the 60s, where people made up composite characters to write the way. The one article particularly stood out to me. It was called Red Pants and Sugar Man, and it was a reporter's article about the prostitution trade in New York. And she had characters that she supposedly interviewed, but they were composites. They weren't real. It was an outrage.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That was before my time.
Right. Well, I'm just saying that is the kind of reporting that reporters back then popularized. And it became a style.
And it's still going on today.
Yeah.
It's coming
still
back.
Going
I've
on
noticed
today.
It.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It is coming back. And,
and the public is unaware of it, though. Well, that's what's so wonderful talking to you, because we raise these issues, and people need to hear it and recognize it. And hopefully they'll be more aware and sensitive to it so they can appreciate what's coming down the pike. Really fascinating. I want to ask you about something else, unless you have another subject you wanted to bring up. You know, there was that major fire in the Bronx. Evidently, somebody used a heater, and evidently that was the cause of the fire. So I guess people don't know how to use a heater, or that a heater should be removed from a flammable item, so you need space where you can heat without causing things to heat up to such an extent where they become, you know, so hot that they burst into a flame. And then also the doors in a big building that should be closed didn't automatically close. how is it that we get to this point? Nobody knows what's going on. Aren't people supposed to be responsible?
And aren't inspected. And if inspected, just say, oh, well, fix it when you have a chance. They don't. And what was interesting is that the owners of this building that had that tragic fire, well, it wasn't tragic. It was manslaughter. That's what it was, because they had doors that did not work. They did not. They had smoke detectors that were so unreliable that people ignored them. And not only that, but they didn't heat the building properly. That's why you have heaters. Now, if you're not heating the building properly, that is a health hazard to everybody in the building. I can tell you, we keep the things down, the temperature about 66 in this house, and that is cold.
That is cold.
You know, I wear a sweater around the house, and we just do it because we're just trying to save a little money. And to my way of thinking, they should throw the book at this outfit. I mean, they're a contributor to Adams, so I don't think that's going to happen. But, I mean, please, there are not buildings like that in New York City. Lots of buildings.
The governor came in, and she's going to give $2 million to take care of all these people that have been displaced.
How about indicting them for negligence? How about charging these owners with a crime?
Absolutely. The landlord, the superintendent, the people who are supposed to sign off on documentation, and the inspectors that didn't do their job, they should all go to prison. And you know what? It's getting pathetic. Nobody's doing their job, and nobody's being held responsible.
Nobody's being held responsible. These rentals, these owners of rental buildings are cheap. They are right out of Charles Dickens. They don't keep
the buildings
in repair.
Well, why do we permit it? Can't we create
because
law?
Officials are paid to look the other way, and they do a laissez-faire job of regulating housing in New York City. And the big question to me is, Paul Finer came out two days after that fire with a big letter about how buildings are inspected in Greenberg, but at no time did anybody from the county, aside from expression of sympathy in a statement, say that they were going to do a sweep of rental buildings in Westchester. Can we assume that rental buildings in Westchester are totally toasty and heated appropriately and all the doors work? Are we assured of that? I thought that was... that's why Paul Finer is hated by every politician in the county, because he does things like that. He raises questions, and he pays attention.
And he's on target. He's on target.
And he is
on
target.
And he's not claustrophobic in only Greenberg. He sees the bigger picture, which goes beyond Greenberg. So he the issues that are raised elsewhere.
He has never been elected county executive. He knows more about it than anybody about running anything. But
I think he's just comfortable. He's in love with Greenberg, and I guess. It's not like he's hungering for more power. I think he's got a tremendous amount of clout, and they love him there. They vote for him
over and over again. Yes, right here in White Plains, as we have buildings that are illegal housing. They're even put out for rent to persons coming into the community by local organizations. And it always is amazing to me that these illegal houses are tolerated by the city. And that's what they are.
We got the same problem in Yonkers. Nobody wants to look.
No, we had 47 people found in one building that caught fire, but thanks to the fact of the White Plains great fire department, nobody was killed. But
thank
the
God
reason
for that.
I remember that about 5-6 years ago. more than that. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that was a wake-up call to the city. And if five or six people had died there, like the persons had died in the Bronx, we would have been front-page news across the country. But nothing has really been done about this illegal housing situations.
No, not at all.
That we know of. How about a sweep of some sort? They never do sweeps. Never.
They're not interested. I think politically it doesn't work. And yet at the same time, I don't understand why someone who comes into office has 4 years or even 3 years more to serve, can't be removed, why they can't do the right thing. I don't get it. I can understand if you only got 6 months to go and you're going through and into an election process and you're afraid you might lose somebody along the way, but it makes no sense. When are we going to become forthright about what we realize is going on wrong?
Tolerance of illegal housing on the premise that, well, these people need to live someplace, but it's really it's greed on the part of owners of two-family houses, basically, that put as many people as possible. They load them with extension cords and all sorts of stuff, and fires start because overloading of electric. Get short circuits, bad wiring. I mean,
don't we have people inspecting that? We have it on the books. They're supposed to be inspected. So why don't we do it?
I always thought so, but what is done? Still happening.
Well, we got a lot of stuff on the books. Everyone says, don't worry, we're taking care of this, we're taking care of that. But at the end of the day, it's not being taken care of, and nobody's overseeing it, and there is no reporting about it, not because of the newspapers reporting it. This is supposed to be reported by different departments of the city, wherever the city may be, and it's not being done.
I once gave the city a list of all these places that are recommended that are illegal, and nothing was ever done. Nothing.
Well, I'm sure they were not too happy to get the letter from you.
Yes, but I mean, the intriguing thing is those are the lists of houses that are recommended by a prominent housing organization in the city, so they should know about it.
Right. Absolutely, they should.
They should check them to see that they're approved housing, but they don't do that.
Amazing, amazing. Any last words from you? We only have about 2 minutes left.
Yes, I have to say that it's very important that Westchester did a good job this weekend. It might have just been the cold, but dropping to below 3,000 infections a day of COVID, dropping is absolutely a terrific job because we averaged 2,400, so that really limited the spread. We dropped it from 25,000 a week last week to down to 16,007, and it is very important that we keep doing it. And I think it means that people are getting less infected because.
But do you think it's because of the cold? But then we're also going to a time when a lot of people are going to get together this week.
Yes. Well, we will just have
we'll
to see
what the numbers
have
are
to
next
realize.
Week.
Yes, because right now the hospital system in Westchester and the Mid-Hudson Valley is going to be stressed if this keeps up. The rest of the area, the Mid-Hudson Valley, is infecting at like 15 to 20%, and Westchester's infecting on much lower basis, much lower. But we have the most because we're the biggest population. And
absolutely.
Yes,
well, John, we have to say goodbye. Thank you so much. We should tell people that you're the publisher and editor of the White Plains Citizenet Reporter, or you can reach it real easily at WPCNR.com. That's how I remember it. And all the best to you, and thanks for your input. As always, a pleasure to start Mondays with you. Take care.
Yes,
be well.
The watch on the Rhine continues.
That's right. Be good. Bye. Okay, let's bring on Mr. Edelman, who's on the line already. Good morning, Mr. Edelman. How are you, sir?
Well, my phone works this week.
I was astounded that a phone could be commandeered.
It's just amazing. They hacked my T-Mobile account and ordered two new iPhones at a price of whatever, $500-$600, putting on my, what they billed me for. That's what they're able to do, these people that know how to, you know, hack into a system like T-Mobile, which is really not all that safe.
Well, you know, that's what's so interesting. I find that it's more difficult for me to sign into my own account, whether it be the bank or this or the other, and they've got one convoluted layer of security after the other. And it's insane. They make it seem that it's secure, but it's not secure at all.
Well,
it's
outrageous. I mean, I have about 50 passwords, different passwords for different accounts. And I have to write them down and keep track in order to keep track of them.
Well, absolutely. I have exactly the same thing. And I have a book. You know, so I guess if anyone breaks into my home, they're gonna. If they find the book, then you know it's all. You might as well kiss myself goodbye. It doesn't work because the information through the computer system is not safe. So they can break in and get your codes.
Correct.
Unbelievable.
Yep, it is.
Well. It's a little bit too much, that's for sure. I wanted to ask you about a lot of things that are happening on the national stage. And you're our go-to guy because you're the national political analyst and the pundit as well. So one of the things that's very interesting, CBS reported in a poll that they released on Sunday that half the respondents said they were frustrated with Joe Biden's presidency.
Yeah.
Why are they frustrated? And is the assault from the other side from the Trumpsters of the world? Are they literally undermining the president, or is the president floundering himself?
Well, it's a combination of two things. First of all, the lack of support basically is coming from the middle. And independents who voted for Joe Biden to be a transition president and to calm everything down after Donald Trump's four years of chaos. They did not vote for radical spending and radical solutions. And that's what's going on here. A guy like Glenn Youngkin, who is a Republican, who basically distanced himself from Donald Trump, won Virginia and started off by saying in his inauguration speech that he was going to represent everybody, whether you voted for him or not. And the first thing he did in office was to issue an edict condemning anti-Semitism. That's something that Donald Trump could never do because he encouraged it. And so you're seeing a new kind of candidate emerge. They are right-of-center candidates, but they're not nuts, okay? So what we need in the Democratic Party is left-of-center candidates that are not nuts. So what's happening is, you know, the Democrats nationally support Joe Biden. He's got 48 of the 50 senators. The problem is he's only got 50 senators, and he needs all of them. And then he needs Kamala Harris to break the tie. And there are two senators that are not buying in to his Build Back Better, $2 trillion plan, Sinema and Manchin, and they're not going to change their mind. Same thing on voting rights.
No, they're not.
Voting rights should not be anything we argue about in this country. Everybody eligible to vote should be able to vote. We shouldn't be throwing that doesn't mean that we don't identify them, but it does mean that we don't put roadblocks in their way. For example, if you're standing in line and somebody gives you a glass of water because it's a three-hour wait in the sun, you shouldn't be penalized for that. There's nothing wrong with that. And if there's a drop box that's 20 miles away instead of around the block, it's going to make it more difficult for you to vote. And that's what they're doing in states throughout the country in order to stop minorities from voting as they did in the past election. They want to stem turnout any way they can. That, to me, is anathema and unconstitutional, and they should be, you know, taken to task for it.
Well, that's the question. Why isn't the nation being taken to task for it? Why don't we hear from people who have clout with different segments of our society and speak up and say, hey, this is wrong, and it wouldn't have happened under my watch?
Well, the problem is people are speaking up, but those states are the same states that are replacing good election workers like Ratzenberger in Georgia with Trump loyalists. Mm-hmm. Because although they failed in 2020 to subvert the democracy, they're going to try it again in 2024 if Trump is the nominee, which is why, well, Trump should be the nominee so he can get beat. He can get beaten for a second time.
Right.
That's the way you get rid of him. You don't stop him from running. You let him run and lose.
Well, there's also a speculation that maybe Hillary Clinton might get into the mix again.
Do you think that's illogical?
I heard it, but I didn't think it would make sense.
Well, look.
Well, do we have a new crop of people, or is everybody going to be an octogenarian? I mean,
well,
come on, it's getting a little bit old.
Been there, done that with Hillary Clinton. She lost an election that she should have won, probably because her personality is such that people cannot warm up to her. And so my money is on the 40-year-olds that are governors or senators, and particularly the guy from California, Gavin Newsom, who I believe will emerge the Democratic candidate for president.
That's amazing. Yeah, but he's really quite brilliant and likable, evidently. What's missing in our very talented. And what's missing in our political system? And is it outrageous what Biden is wanting as far as investment money and investment in the country? Isn't that necessary? Because we've been backlogged for years. We've been stymied because we haven't invested.
I totally agree with you. I think every once in a while a president comes along that has to change the dynamic. Franklin Delano Roosevelt did. Ronald Reagan did, but now we are so far behind other countries in terms of our infrastructure that bill that was passed was supported by 10 Republicans because they know how badly the bridges in their own states and their highways in their own states are. Now we have an opportunity to pass Build Back Better, which, you know, may or may not result in inflation. I'm not really all that concerned about the inflation that comes out of a bill like that, because you're not going to see it right away. It's going to be in the system, and we have neglected spending on all kinds of things. We need to do it, I think, but two senators don't agree. And so Joe Biden is stuck with 48 senators, and that's not enough. And it's not going to get any better because the Democrats are not going to – I don't think they're going to keep the Senate and the House. They're going to lose both. And it looks now.
Where does that impetus come from? Is it because of the rhetoric has been so strongly against this new president, and from a political perspective, they don't want a Democrat to win? But in the meantime, the nation is waning because of it. I mean, when does it stop? I mean, is it such a bad thing for him to succeed? Okay, and you could throw him out at the end of his 4-year term, and then it's over.
Yeah, but
I don't understand it.
Because the Republicans want to undermine him. That's why they're doing what they're doing with vaccinations. That's why they're scaring people into thinking that vaccines are actually worse than the disease. If you watch these right-wing provocateurs like Alex Jones and Bongino and others like him, and they want the president to fail. And in order to get him to fail, they need to advocate measures that kill their own supporters, because those people who are dying are the unvaccinated. And if you look at a map of the United States, far more people in red counties that are unvaccinated than in blue counties. And those are the people that are dying. So think about Georgia, Arizona, Pennsylvania, as states that can go either way. But what happens if 10,000 red state voters in those states die between now and 2024 because they refuse to take a vaccine because they watched right-wing nonsense?
Well, is that going to change the capacity when the next presidential election comes, or even the local elections come about?
Well, I'm suggesting
so many people are dying.
That's correct. I'm suggesting, for the first time ever, I don't think anybody else has made this argument, that if enough
people...
Who
was ahead of the curve?
If enough people
maybe
die in those states that are Trump voters, that are Republican voters, the Democrats going to win that state.
Yeah. Your suggestion.
Well, yeah. So, you know, but they don't care about
that.
I'm
sure we're going to be able to
bank on
that
Joe Biden
next year. Yeah, absolutely. Unbelievable. Oh, God. Well, there are other things that are happening on the national stage. One thing that was recently reported was KCBS Radio in San Francisco. It reported that because hotels and restaurants are struggling with their ongoing staff shortages, that they have started to now buy a robot called WALL-E, WALL-E, and this machine can make the rounds cleaning up the Radisson Hotel as it does in Sunnyvale, California. It's going to be a disruptor to people who are in the lower socioeconomic ladder. And what are we going to do about all those people that are not going to be able to earn a living? And why is business willing to invest in a machine like that, even though
because,
on the long haul, they're not going to need to pay more time?
Well, this way, if you have humans working at those jobs, you get people that call in sick. You get people that skip a day because they got to take their kids to the doctor. Robots don't call in sick.
No, they're there every day. 24/7.
So no matter what they cost over time, they become cheaper than human labor. I can't see a robot cleaning a room and making a bed. I don't know that that's possible yet, but they are going to be delivering food room by room. They can do that.
They can do vacuuming
up and do that and stuff like that. But so it's a disruption, but you're still going to need people to cook the food. You're going to need people in the hospitality business to serve the food at the front desk to register the people in and all of that. So I'm not sure how disruptive that's going to be.
Well, but we don't have a program that will train people, let's say, to be a chef, because that's intensive work. I mean, not everybody is made to be a chef. Or to cook a particular meal or has knowledge in the different cuisines and knows how to serve a particular society in which they will have a restaurant or in a hotel, whatever. Are we investing in the right manner to train people who are not really earning a good enough living and getting them off the dole? We're not. Why not?
Well, it's not about getting. I don't think it's about getting them off the dole. I think it's about recognizing that everybody is not equipped to go to college. And
absolutely.
if we had more vocational high school, they could actually learn a career, regardless of what the career is—cooking or EMT or anything like that. We'd be better off. We don't have enough of those vocational opportunities and we should.
Why did we drop that? Why did we drop that? We used to have it, didn't we, 10 years ago? There were programs for that. Not everybody wants to be a bank guard, and they don't pay much anyway.
Well, that's true. Minimum wage is another story. We need to up minimum wage, okay, because people can't make $10, $12, $14 an hour. That's not a little wage.
Mm-hmm.
You have to work too in that.
Absolutely.
So we have to do something about that too. People shouldn't have to work two jobs. One job should be enough. One 60-hour a week job should be enough. $20 an hour, you know, that would do it.
So why are we reluctant? Why are we reluctant to move it up in increments so that we can arrive at a much better level, so that we don't have to be concerned about, what people getting by on a regular salary?
That's a good question, because you look at Republicans in the United States Congress, they've opposed basically every attempt for a national minimum wage. They don't believe that a minimum wage should be set by anything other than the market. They believe that having a minimum wage of that high will put small businesses out of business. So there's been no effort.
But even small business is not going out of business. But small business is not going out of business. Even if you go to a fast food joint, it doesn't cost that much. You can literally charge an extra 5 cents for a hamburger these fast food joints, and that would be able to pay people $15 an hour easily, even though $15 an hour means absolutely nothing in a city like New York or other big cities.
Yeah.
That's not a living. It just doesn't make sense. So
but that's the argument that's made, though. And since
I know
Republicans
it's the argument,
have
but
half,
then,
so that's why the minimum wage doesn't go up.
Yeah, but at the same time, too, who's is the government supposed to guarantee that businesses like fast food joints don't have to pay a living wage? I mean,
no.
Why is that?
Why is what? Why does the government?
Why do we permit them not to pay a living wage when? Why is the worker supposed to be there for nothing? Practically, that's what's going on. And then a lot of old people are working there, and they're working in their 60s and 70s. At some of these fast food joints, they can't retire. And then we're giving money to through the earned income tax credit to validate big business, like the Walmarts of the world. So we're subsidizing them, but we're not subsidizing the worker. Where's the logic in all of this?
Well, that's what happens in a capitalist society. You have two sides to the story. And if you don't have the numbers on your side, you don't get to do what you want to do. And that's why Joe Biden can't get his programs through.
Yeah. And somehow that's not resonating. Why is the other side resonating? Well, the public,
well, it resonates
with a
one
lot
side.
Of people who support the Democrat president and others on the other side, they don't.
That's right.
But I also don't understand whatever happened to nationalism and what's good for America comes first.
Well, that was what Donald Trump said, but he was into populism.
No, he wasn't into that.
White Christian nationalism, not what comes first for the nation. If you go to European countries, I know people call them socialists, but you don't see anybody starving and living on the street in Europe.
No, you don't.
A home. Everybody eats. Everybody drinks cappuccino at 4 in the afternoon because they don't have to work because they have pensions. Okay, we don't have that.
Yeah.
We don't have that situation.
No.
We have a situation where a supply and demand in the market determines whether you have a job, whether you can buy a house, and all of that. And so there are problems in an all-capitalist society. We're not all capitalist.
Mm-hmm.
We're a mixed economy. But the closer you get pure capitalism, the more you have people that fall through the cracks. And that's what we have.
Unbelievable. Well, there's a third point I wanted to bring up to you, and that was that Donald Trump held a rally in Arizona this weekend on Saturday. He admonished anyone who dared to question his lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen, including the Arizona governor, Doug Ducey, I hope that's the way he pronounces it, and South Dakota Senator Mike Rounds acknowledged the reality that the election was in fact fair. And even Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell agreed that informing the party they needed to tell voters the truth about the 2020 campaign. What's holding this stuff up?
It's a slow process of accretion. They don't want to get in Trump's face, all of them at once. But they want to slowly, it's like turning a tanker. You know, it takes a very long time to turn an oil tanker around. And so these people are, where they're trying not to draw fire from Donald Trump, they're doing it one at a time. But what you're seeing is an organized expression of Republicans who are in office that they recognize that Joe Biden won the election and that Trump is lying to his supporters.
Well, a lot of Republicans are suggesting that Trump is a loser, quote unquote. What are they afraid of from him? What are they afraid of from him? What can he conceivably do?
Have you ever seen Donald Trump attack somebody? He attacked very, very carefully. He's a name caller.
Yes, he does.
He's
a name caller.
Called Romney choked like a dog. So he's a name caller. So they want to try and not do that. You got Ron DeSantis.
Sounds like a bully in high school.
That's exactly what he is. That's exactly what Donald Trump is. That's how he ran his life. And that's how he was taught. He was taught by his father to be a bully. And since he's 6'3" and 270 pounds, he can pretty much get away with it.
Right. I guess so. He's like a very big man out of control, you know, physically. So it's just not good. You never know. But is this the sort of demeanor that's acceptable in the nation? Is it that they want to side with him? Some people want to side with the former president because they think he's powerful. What are they getting out of it?
Well, first of all,
it just doesn't seem there's anything conducive.
It's a white grievance situation. If you look at the people that invaded the Capitol on January 6th, you see people that are physically very resembling of Donald Trump. They're large.
Yes.
They're uneducated for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And they're mad. And the reason they're mad is
that
they've been told that their power as white Christians is going to be diminished by the browning of America. And they don't want that to happen. So when Donald Trump said there are great people, there are fine people on both sides after the Charlottesville March, where the marchers were chanting, "Jews shall not replace us," these people sprang into action. January 6th committee is going to reveal that this insurrection was planned way in advance, that the paramilitary groups like the Oath Keeper and the Proud Boys participated in it, planned it, and did it together with some members of Congress.
You know what I don't understand, and I mean this seriously because I'm not finger-pointing at anybody, but when we realized what was going on January 6th, it took a tremendous amount of time to really delve into what really happened, and we're still finding out what happened. Is there nobody in government that would have been able to leak out this information? Is the difficulty in revealing all this stuff, even if you don't attach your name to it? And yet, as somebody can validate who you are, then why is that a problem?
That's what's happening now privately with the January 6th Commission. They've interviewed over 300 people. By the time they're done, it'll probably be five times that. People are cooperating with them that were in the Trump White House working for Trump, who saw exactly what happened on the 6th, who will testify publicly when they have their first public hearing. so that they will lay out step by step, inch by inch, exactly what happened and who was responsible. And that will be the time when the nation gets rid of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. And how much longer do you think it'll take before we reach that point? By the end of this year?
By elections.
Hopefully. By elections.
By the end of October.
Okay. Well, that will be a crucial moment. I wonder how the nation will react to that.
Well, you're going to see hearings.
Recuperation on one side and... Sorry?
Hearings are going to be at night. The hearings are going to be held at night when everybody can watch them rather than during the day. So people will come home from work at 7 or 8 o'clock at night. They're going to see the hearings, and they're going to hear the testimony of the witnesses. And they will establish beyond any doubt at all that Donald Trump manipulated, wanted to overturn the legitimate counting of the electoral votes on January 6th, and that he orchestrated it, and that people invaded the Capitol because they believed that Donald Trump wanted them to do that, and that there were other members of the United States Congress that were criminally culpable, along with Donald Trump, in planning and executing the attack. And once that becomes clear, there'll still be 25% of Republicans that'll like Donald Trump, but there'll be 15 or 20% that did like him that will no longer like him, that will go with somebody else in 2024. And as one of the commentators said, Ann Coulter yesterday, when she was called up for a comment by the New York Times, she said, Donald Trump is done. What don't you get?
Wow. That's unbelievable. What a quote. What has Donald Trump commandeered and taken over the Republican Party? Can the Republican Party ever resurrect itself without him at the head of the helm? And is it conceivable that we could function with only one party that has so much control? And it may be like for one term, but then can the Republicans resuscitate themselves? Or will they redirect themselves into something different?
The Republicans can rehabilitate themselves once they get rid of Donald Trump and once the people that cooperated and enabled Donald Trump, like Steve Bannon, Roger Stone, Don Jr., a whole host of other people, are read out of the party. Bill
and
Buckley
even
50 read the John Birch Society out of the party.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was amazing the way he did it. So in a sense, that's the prospect. We're going to go through tumultuous times until we get to all these processes, but at least it's toward the end of this year, and we may get some solution. And do you see, you don't have to name anyone in particular, but do you see that there's a prospect for change in the Republican Party? Are people starting to try to create a platform that will resonate with people without Trump around?
Yeah, if you look at Glenn Youngkin, who was sworn in as Virginia's governor, that's exactly the model that they're going to follow.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a Trump person. Neither are Mitt Romney and all the other senators that voted to convict. Neither is Liz Cheney or Adam Kinzinger and many other members of the House that are afraid to speak out. So there will be rehabilitation.
Liz Cheney?
Yeah.
Well, Liz Cheney, because she's a woman, is that going to, and that she was in a sense a renegade, that she was the first one out of the gate, you know, against Trump? She took an independent line. She's probably a major front runner, also because of age, too, I would think.
Yeah, that's right.
She's a young woman.
She's
not 65.
And she's also a rock rib conservative.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Well, we're in for some very interesting times, And thank God you're there to steer us in the right direction so we can understand what's going on. When you were over at the telephone company with regard to your cell phone, did they give you some concepts of how to protect your phone from getting taken over, absconded
by calling them up as soon as you recognize that somebody's fooling around so they can reverse the charges. Uh-huh.
Unbelievable. And how did you see that? Were you able to recognize
that? Well, I saw that my account was charged for $500 for two iPhones. And then I got text messages telling me I was going to get delivery of two iPhones, which I didn't order.
Right.
With the order number.
Unbelievable.
And so then I traced it to somebody who lived in Winter Park who used the name Michael Edelman to obtain the phones.
Unbelievable. It's amazing that that could be done. Well, live and learn.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much, as always. An exhilarating half hour. A great way to start a Monday. You stay healthy, whatever you do. The best to your family.
I'm trying.
Thank you.
Same to you.
Thank you. All the best. Well, there we are with none other than Michael Edelman, a national political analyst and pundit. Just really fantastic. Always worthwhile talking to him because there's always something more to learn. And speaking of learning, I see that our next guest is already on, Ron Matten. How are you, sir? Good morning.
Good morning, Hezzy. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. You know, I'm always pleased to have you on a Monday so we could start off the week right. You know, John Bailey from the White Plains Citizenette Reporter, and then Michael Edelman, and then you. I mean, it doesn't get better than that. And then it wanes in the last half hour when I'm only online. What are you going to do, right? Not everyone is a stellar character.
I'm sure it's still riveting.
Let's hope. I want to ask you about something that is like in our face, and that is the building in the Bronx that had burned, and it's evident that there wasn't enough heating in the building, which caused some people who probably didn't know how to have a heater in the home where too much that is flammable could blow up into flames because you need to leave enough room so that the heater doesn't cause things to get on fire. But the problem was not that the heater probably could have been, I'm not sure if it was overloaded or if it overloaded the wiring system or what caused that particular fire, or if it was just that clothing close by caught on fire. But the point is that the building did not have enough heat. And who's going to be responsible for this fire? And then we had other problems, too, where doors that are supposed to divide the building didn't automatically close. What about the landlord? What about the superintendent? Is anyone responsible for this? And thank God the governor came in and invested $2 million to help these people out.
Yeah, let's kind of go back.
There's a lot to
unpack. Let's go back to your initial statement, which was regarding the sufficiency of heating. So this building is located in the Bronx, and New York City does have a requirement for heat regardless of the outdoor temperature. It's based on the inside temperature of the apartment. So that is the minimum heat for your apartment should be 68 degrees during the day if it's below 55 outside. And at night, it needs to be 62 degrees, regardless of the outdoor temperature. So even if it's, whatever the temperature is outdoors at night, I believe that this happened in the evening. Has he remind me?
I don't know myself, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I didn't pay attention when the fire began.
So there is a minimum requirement, and I've lived in apartment buildings. And my apartments have tended to be overheated where you open the windows. But let's also look at the code for electrical portable heaters. When you're using an electrical portable heater, actually this is not the code, this is common sense. The heater should be of a base that is wider than the top, so the heater is stable. It should have some sort of mechanism that if the heater tips over, the heater will shut off. And then the requirement is that the heater be 3 feet away from any flammables like bedding, furniture, or any combustibles or flammables.
Right.
That the heat should be far enough away, and also that it's not in a path of travel. So if you know, you have a heater, let's say by a doorway that is often used, well, you should try to put it in a different location. I work at a college. We manage dormitories. Often what I find, we also manage offices. Often what I find is when people are a little cold, they'll take a small cube heater and they'll put it under their desk and keep themselves warm. Well, that's not a good location for it. It's in an enclosed area. The desk is generally what's known as MDF, which is a type of compressed wood. And it's combustible.
Wow.
So, and you also want to make sure it's not plugged into an extension cord. It should be plugged in directly into a receptacle, and that you're not using also a surge protector. A lot of times people use surge protectors and extension cords, and they're not rated. They're not rated for the type of amperage that an electrical heater will draw. So those are some of the
there's a lot to know.
That lead to,
there's
well,
a lot to know. I mean, how do people know about this?
Well, when you buy an appliance, you should read the directions.
That's
they should
true.
Be in the directions. And the heater should be UL listed, Underwriter Laboratory. You don't want to buy one of these things off of Amazon that came from a factory in China. That has no Underwriters Laboratory listing, which means it's not been tested.
Right.
So you want to make sure you're buying a good product and not something that's has no seal of approval, if you will. And the Underwriters Lab is the gold standard.
So when somebody rents an apartment in a rental building, Are they required to sign off on these standards that are required in order to keep their apartment safe as well as the building safe? How does one become responsible, or will they ever be responsible for something that began in their particular apartment? Is the superintendent responsible? Is the landlord responsible? Who's going to take the blame for this?
And
should
I
there be blame?
It's hard and maybe heartless to blame the victims, but you know, you do have a responsibility. I know this was largely an immigrant community in the building, and you know, English may not be the first language, and maybe buying a product probably from a 99-cent store or a bodega type store because you're cold. But it's important for those community organizations also within the immigrant communities to help spread the word about what's safe and what's not. So
I'm not looking to blame anybody, but then why don't we have legislation that will require anybody selling anything? So many people who speak Spanish as their first language may not even understand English well enough. So why don't we demand that everything be written in Spanish as well as English? You know, if you get a product from Europe, you get it in German, in French, in Italian, in English, I mean, in Spanish as well. What's the problem?
And I believe this was a community, and you do, sometimes you thumb through, 20 pages before you find the English text.
Right.
I believe, was a community maybe from Senegal. So it wasn't a Spanish community. It was a It was a one of the African countries. Right. And I think many of them speak French.
Yeah, they do in Senegal.
Yeah, you're right. It should be, it should be multilingual. New York City is not monolingual anymore.
No.
Like I said, I'm not blaming the tenants, but the tenants do have a responsibility to make sure that they're using the product sufficiently. And again, what was the heat in the building? You know,
is anybody really blaming the tenants for this?
I think they're
ignorant of what they should have done. But then, look, even the landlord should be sending out a notice, you know, as we approach winter. Say, look, if you need this, this is what you need. But at the same time, why a newly bought item or whether they've had it for a few years? I don't know, but what is pertinent here is that the landlord did not supply the heat. So is the landlord responsible for this fire?
Well, again,
I think he is, or she.
Well, the landlord has a lot of culpability in what happened. I don't know that
absolutely.
The landlord didn't supply the heat. A lot of times people feel 68 is not warm enough.
It doesn't matter what people think, it's the law, but the point is we understand that he didn't give the heat to 68.
Well, Hezzy, I don't know that. I know people were using a heater. I don't know that if they weren't comfortable at 68 and then used a heater.
We don't have to commit, but the point is why would anybody have a heater if there is enough heat in the building? Because they think it's cold at 68?
Some people think it's – look, I've worked property management for a long time. And I set my heating at 68 to 72, which is the ASHRAE standard, the American Society for Heating Engineer Association, Heating Engineering Association, and Heating Refrigeration and Air Conditioning Engineers.
Right.
So we use the ASHRAE standard, which is 68 to 72, which is recognized by the federal government for heating. And it's quite possible that I've noted people saying that they're cold at those temperatures.
But I have a sweater, and if I'm cold, I wear a sweater.
I'm home today.
I like to sleep in the nude, but you know, if I'm really that cold, even with the, you know, you could get a little more information than I need. Well, no, I mean I can wear a pajama. I don't have a problem.
So I'm home today. I sleep in the nude.
All
right. I'm home today. I keep my house at 65 because I pay my heating oil bills. And I wear a sweatshirt around the house, but that's my prerogative.
Good for you.
I'm wearing a sweatshirt because I'm a little chilly, but I don't want to, push that button to turn the heater on. Let's talk about where we definitely know the landlord was culpable. All right, the building is required to have self-closing doors in the stairwells and apartment doors.
Right,
and that should be inspected. It should be inspected by the super, who's an agent of the landlord. So in that case,
well, evidently it wasn't. So who's responsible if someone didn't check it off?
That is absolutely where the landlord is fully responsible. And if he didn't supervise his superintendent, if the superintendent falsifies the log, the landlord is still responsible.
Correct.
So yes, I'm sure there'll be a criminal investigation for this. I believe 17 lives were lost, 8 of which were children.
Mm-hmm.
And we really need to make sure that the codes in these buildings, particularly in these highly dense areas, are followed, because that's where you tend to have. Look, if you live in a residential area that's single family or multi dual family homes. It's not as big a deal. It's usually only the families who are displaced, who are injured. We had a major fire here in Yonkers on Elliott Street a few weeks ago. And, you know, we should be looking at the same instances. What was the cause? Was there sufficient heat? I don't, do you recall if that was a, an electric heater situation?
I don't know. I didn't get notice of it. So the fire department didn't send me any notification, so I was unaware of it.
Okay. Yeah,
but the issue is that there's a lot of dwellings, whether in private homes that are not legal, and they're still being rented, and that's acceptable behavior, and it's been going on for 20 years. As that I'm aware of, and we have no rules and regulations for it either. In most cases, nothing happens, and thank God that's fine. But even so, that shouldn't be permitted because it's not permitted by law. So even though things should be done, they're not. How do we fix that? How do we make sure? Like for example, this particular incident in the Bronx. No matter how everything transpired, eventually they'll find out exactly what did or did not transpire, who was responsible or who should have been responsible or who could have been responsible and didn't do their job. There should be some sort of paperwork to prove that this thing was inspected, that thing was inspected, that the heat was at a particular point. That there was a failing of the equipment for the, you know, the heater, and also maybe to point out, hey, you're not allowed to bring in these sort of items into the building if they're not UL approved, and maybe we should do something as well if you order something from an Amazon, maybe we should demand that every product be in all the different languages. And what's wrong with having five major languages when you buy a product so that you understand whether it conforms to UL regulations or not? I mean,
right.
I know that everyone says everything is perfect. Don't worry about it. Do this, do that. Everything will be fine, but it's not fine. And if we don't put these in prison, we're never going to learn.
Yeah, look.
What's to deter us from doing it again tomorrow?
So you can generally tell the product, and again, this is hard for people who are not initially from here, but, you know, if the product comes with instructions that are poorly translated, it's probably not a product that you should be using. You want something.
Absolutely.
I try to buy name brand. When I'm buying electrical products, I try to buy name brand products. I don't want to burn my house down. There are FDNY requirements for inspections of residential buildings. So we need to know, you know, who was the fire inspector? You know, did he go through? Did this building get cited? These are all, you know, New York City is pretty good with their online records. They have a DOB, Department of Buildings database, where you can look up any property by block and lot, and it'll tell you the number of violations that building has had, say, over the last 20 years, and whether they've been repaired or not. So this was supposedly a flameproof building without fire escapes. It was required to have fireproof egress routes with self-closing doors along those egress routes and self-closing apartment doors. Those are all things that should have been checked on the last fire inspection.
What about the responsibility of the landlord if you have people who can afford to rent a particular place, and in this particular place it was in the Bronx, and they're of Senegalese descent, so they probably do speak French. Is it important for the landlord to also be able to give them documentation written in their language so they understand it, other than we'll just sign here and off you go, and they don't even know what the responsibility is for them? Why are we not engaging language in order to meet the needs of so many people who are coming to America, and we permit them to come to America, and they want to live here, and they work, and yet they don't have much support. So these things can happen because they're ignorant, not because they're stupid, because they don't have the facts. They don't know. It's different in Senegal than it is here.
Yeah. So I'm not an attorney, so I can't comment on the obligations for private companies to provide dual languages of their clients. You know, their clients, their tenants.
It doesn't need to be legal. How about just being smart and sensitive to the idea that if you have people who don't know, they can create a problem, which is what happened in this case.
Right. I would say that it's moral. It's moral to be able to provide that information in a way that your tenant or your client can understand what they're doing, what they're signing. You know, you're signing a lease.
Yeah.
You want to make sure that your tenant understands their obligations under the lease.
Exactly.
It's good for everybody involved, tenant, landlord, people who work in the building. So yeah, I agree that would be the appropriate thing to do. And many times these buildings have tenant associations.
We have to recognize, too, that even if you don't have the capacity to translate it on your own, then you know what? There's Google Translate. The landlord could certainly translate everything that they have into whatever language the particular tenant may speak, and also in English. So you got the English version, you got the French version. If you need it in German, then you have it in the German version. It only takes 1 second for Google Translate to recognize what it is you're writing and what language it's in, and it'll translate into English or any other language. Literally, it's unbelievable. And it may colloquial, but it's understandable. I speak enough languages to know when I go to Google, just in case, and I want to check something because I don't remember a particular word and I put it in there. Hey, it's very nicely written.
Yeah, it's pretty
that
close.
Simple. It's not flowery. It's just simple.
So I'm just pulling up, while we were talking, apparently the landlord of that building in the Bronx had 17 open fire violations. In that building, the Camber Property Group. So they have a history, and again, there's not. I don't know if 17 is a lot. A lot of times, and I don't know if they've been repaired. But there were 17 open violations in that.
Well, you know that. Look, I don't want to admonish them for anything. Because, like you said, we're not sure of this, that, or the other. But if they had 17 deficiencies of some sort for which they were cited, there should be a mechanism to have that fixed, and it needs to be expunged once it is fixed so that, you know, it's there. You could say, well, there was a violation, but it was fixed. And then how did it come about that somebody discovered there was a violation of some sort or a deficiency of some sort, however you want to do it from a legal perspective?
Right.
These are the sort of things that our laws, they claim they fix, but they don't. And then people get killed because of it. And what's so difficult about it? I don't get it. What's so difficult?
These are important points that you bring up.
You're more salient than I am, so what can I tell you? But
it's important points. Look, I know it is difficult to clear the fire violations once they're on. But you know, when you get a violation, here's what happens. You get a notice. It says you have a violation, and then you have a certain number of days to fix that violation. And if you fix that from the notice of violation within those certain number of days, it doesn't turn into a violation. So you have a grace period.
Well, so, somebody needs to be able to recognize that there is a violation being asserted, and then that it can be remedied. And so somebody didn't answer the initial alleged violation. So that's
right.
How you get it. That's a lack of concern, and it basically says, screw you. We don't care about the law because it doesn't matter. Because nobody's going to jail. Nobody's paying a fine. That's the problem. I would sue these people through the wall.
Maybe
if I was a lawyer, but I'm not a lawyer.
Right. So maybe it's time for the city to take this out of civil matters and move these move these type of violations when you start to have egregious ignorance, ignoring of the law. You move it into a criminal. Move into a criminal court, and then you'll see how many people start fixing what they need to fix, or decide that.
Do you think the New York City Council would promote that sort of legislation? Should we have something like that in Yonkers? It would make sense to me. It would make sense for the entire state, and it would make sense to me and the entire nation.
Well, I think we have a lot of work here in Yonkers within our codes enforcement. The building department here in Yonkers enforces codes, and we don't really have quite a building department yet.
No.
As you know, the commissioner either resigned or was let go last month.
Right.
And the department is still in somewhat disarray as they try to put themselves
together. Hopefully they'll get that done in another month or two. I mean, it's a little bit ridiculous that they don't have somebody to replace, the missing, hierarchy.
Right. But
so
I don't know why
that's taking some time.
Perhaps they need to hire more enforcement officials and actually have a task force for checking on landlord complaints. I'm sure, we have a pretty robust number of tenant unions here. Although you have to look at the other side of that too. If you have a largely immigrant community in a building who may not be here legally, they may be afraid to make complaints because they don't know that they can't be sent back to their country. So they, when you have a large immigrant community.
But again, even for that, isn't there any way to get around these issues? Is it so difficult if you're going to have somebody sign a lease agreement and they may be scared of being shipped back to wherever the original homeland was? Shouldn't they be informed of what their rights are? And that they can actually contact somebody to get it fixed? Is there going to be some sort of pushback? Legally, they're allowed to stay here. Who's going to push them out? A city, a county, a state, the nation is going to push them out when they were in the right? I mean, we're always looking for excuses, but the excuses are just, they fall flat in my mind. I don't understand it, and I don't understand why people don't have a means.
This is an area where elected officials really need to reach out, and there's a lot of community organizations. There's Korean, there's Chinese, there's Spanish organizations, Latino organizations
that reach out to
folks in the
community. Where are they? Do you hear anything from the Korean community? I don't.
And again, in New York City, there is in Elmhurst in particular, there are larger Asian organizations that serve the community, whether
through
temples or we don't see that as much here in Yonkers. We have a large growth in our Latino/Hispanic organization or population, so we've kind of seen more advocacy for that group, but not for others.
But nothing about nothing about these sort of issues, you know, such as God forbid, you know, a crisis like that burned down the building, and people got killed.
We also have a lot of illegal
places where people are renting. And we have a law against it, but we permit it.
We do, and that's in particular a problem for the fire department. When they come in to fight a fire, and if an apartment has been subdivided in such a way to provide private living quarters where they don't meet code, that makes it difficult for the firefighters and dangerous, dangerous for the firefighters.
Very dangerous.
So, yeah, I've advocated, you know, so a couple of things we have going on that interlink, and I've got a little pushback, but I've advocated that we do a reval, a property reval on homes here in Yonkers. That would do two things.
Mm-hmm.
One is it would identify the illegal construction, and two, get the property values at the right level, where we're taxing at the right level. We pay millions and millions of dollars in tax certiorarii every year because we're charging people the wrong amount of property tax. They dispute it, and then we owe them a payment for several years. And we don't pay that money. We borrow that money. And we've been cited by Tom DiNapoli as that being a bad practice. So if we were to do
it is
reval,
a bad practice.
If we did a reval every, let's say, 15 years, which costs money, but it also costs, you know, it costs us $6 to $8 million a year to do these tax certiorari borrowings.
Well, who's promoting this?
So that might be a solution.
It is a solution, but who's promoting this sort of legislation? And it's not fully explained to a lot of people. I mean, I spoke about it years ago, but it's like deaf ears. Like, people are not interested. I don't know why they're not interested in tackling this issue. You know,
because
sometimes
if you're elected,
you could be a lone voice.
Yeah, the problem with it is when you're elected, it's very easy to tag an official as, oh, he wants to raise your taxes. He's going to have somebody come in and reevaluate your property. Now, if you built a swimming pool and you didn't file a permit for it in the back, shame on you. You've been ripping off the city for so long.
Mm-hmm.
Because your neighbors are
right.
paying, your neighbors are paying the tax you should pay. So I'd love that person's vote. I would much rather support people who are doing things right, went out, filed permits, and did the proper thing that they're supposed to do.
I don't want to
so
keep you on
I'll,
for
I'll,
longer because of
yeah.
our time slot. However,
right.
however, what I want to ask you is there no other means to get that sort of message out without anyone being admonished and just simply getting out the information? Or is there no mechanism whatsoever that people recognize?
So I think it would be good for
not that I have
City
a solution.
Hall,
I'm not going to tell people what to do and how to do or when to do it or where to do it.
I'm just
flabbergasted that people don't know.
So the mayor's got a microphone. I think it would be good for City Hall. I think it would be good for City Hall to go out, talk about fire safety tips. You could have the fire department visit various neighborhoods. I know they do it. I know they do it in municipal housing. Let's
mm-hmm.
look at doing it, you know, at some of the precincts, at some of the libraries, and we should have a fire safety week where we.
So how about you running for political office? How about you running for political office? Maybe we need that. We don't have that clear voice. I hate to tell you.
I tried that, and you know the old adage: if at first you don't succeed,
you got to try again.
So I haven't. I still feel that I can improve things here, and I'm still interested in running for office. So more to come by the end of this year. But yeah, I think that I have a lot to offer the city. The city needs to. Really do a fire safety week where we get out to the libraries. We get even in the schools, if you make it part of the curriculum, the kids come home and remind their parents, hey, you know, that heater's too close to the bedspread.
Yeah,
maybe
they'll tell
you.
Maybe
we need to move it back because Because kids like to tell their parents when they're doing the wrong thing. So it's not bad to also bring that into the school curriculum because it gets out.
Well, maybe we should be inviting the fire department to come to the schools and talk about these sort of things, classroom by classroom.
Yeah, well,
it's important.
So schools are supposed to be inspected by the fire department yearly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably not a bad idea to also have a little fire day when they're doing the inspection.
Mm. Good point. Well, listen,
so
I don't want to keep you on for too long. I've already kept you on longer than our half hour slot.
Okay.
Thank you a million
for
your input
and the conversation. You're welcome. Thank you, Andy.
Always. Thank you. Stay well and stay healthy. Stay warm. Without a heater.
Yeah, I got my sweatshirt on. I'm good. All right. Bye-bye.
God bless you. Take care. Bye. There we have it, folks. None other than Ron Matten. He's a Yonkers politician. He ran for political office, and he's going to run again. That is really fantastic. So that's something to look forward to. We'll find out eventually when he does. So let me quickly look at some other issues here. Kind of him to go beyond our time slot, which was really important. A couple of very important issues have taken place. The Westchester County Executive, George Latimer, issued a statement on the 16th. That was actually on the 15th. I only got notice of it or reached it on the 16th. But it was on the 15th he wrote the following. The entire county of Westchester mourns the death of Reginald A. Lafayette. Reggie had a long and distinguished career as a public servant. He was politically brilliant, and it is without doubt that no person did more to bring diversity to the city and county government than did Reggie. He was insightful and tempered. He was my friend for nearly 50 years, starting when we were both young men in Mount Vernon, where we both first became active in the community. We shared meals, advice, and even coached a little league team together. Today, the news of his passing seems surreal. Tomorrow, we will go forward and we will carry on and remember his legacy of working for voting rights, diversity, and equal opportunity for all in government. I grieve with his children, his many friends and colleagues. And I did point out at the bottom of this that the notice was issued on January 15th, but I dated it on the 16th because that's when I was able to post it. So something to recognize, that's for sure. Now, let me go on to some other things you might find important. This is really very important, I think. This is about police. Heroic police should be praised. Why? Because they deserve it. And here's one example. This is written by Jim Rada, R-A-D-A. He's based out of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. He wrote that on January 9 of 2022, Mark Jenkins, a 70-year-old former U.S. Air Force fighter pilot, took off from Whiteman Airport in Pacoima, California, California, in a Cessna 172. Unfortunately, the small plane lost power and crash-landed on the street, sliding onto railroad tracks. Well, the crash left Jenkins dazed inside the cockpit. Typically, this would have been a major issue. He would have come to his senses before long, and the experienced Air Force fighter pilot would deal with the problem, except for one problem. A train was heading at full speed toward the plane, unable to stop in time. So it was a good thing for Mr. Jenkins that the Pacoima Police Department was not defunded. Quote, "I saw the plane come down," said Police Sergeant Joseph Cavastani. He was one of the four Los Angeles Police Department officers who responded to the emergency within 5 minutes of the crash. Quote, "It had looked like he was sideways. I requested our communications to stop all rail activity," end quote. The police officer spoke to the pilot to keep him conscious. Then came the sound of bells and flashing lights signaling an oncoming train, the responding officers recalled during the press conference. Quote, we looked, and sure enough, there was a train headed right for us at full speed, Officer Robert Sherlock, another responding officer, said. Two Los Angeles Police Department officers pulled the bloodied pilot from the plane and ran from the tracks while carrying Jenkins' body to safety. One officer's body cam caught the incident on video. Seconds later, a train smashed the wrecked plane to smithereens. Still been aboard, he assuredly would have been killed. Instead, the video seems to show a piece of the wreckage barely missing, hitting the police. And despite watching the train heading straight at them, unable to stop in time, the Los Angeles Police Department officers did their job. They risked their lives and went to the plane and rescued the pilot. Because of the heroism of officers, Police Sergeant Cavastani, Police Officer Robert Sherlock, Police Officer Damien Castro, and Officer Christopher Aboit, the pilot, Mark Jenkins, is still alive. This is one reason that a well-trained police force is needed. How many civilians would have been willing to put their lives on the line like that? This incident was a dramatic example of heroism within the ranks of police forces across the country. Some police officers' act of heroism may not be as movie-worthy as this incident, but they are just as important to the people they help by putting their own lives at risk. Last year, the Millvale, Pennsylvania, police officer Joe Spalik was the first officer on a bad house fire scene. Neighbors yelled that three people were trapped inside. He found two people in the court in the backyard, but he ran into the house to find a woman who had run back inside for her purse and medication. In Arizona, Phoenix police officer Joel Kaminsky and Rudy Castillo rescued a driver from a burning car. In 2020, Lodi police officer Erica Uria, I guess Lodi in New Jersey, saved a man's life after his wheelchair got stuck on railroad tracks while he was crossing. The train couldn't stop in time, but Uria rushed forward, grabbed the man, and pulled him away from the oncoming train. These are just a few rescues where police endangered their own lives to save another. They didn't do these things for glory, fame, or social justice. They did them because it was the right thing to do. They did it because they greatly love the people they serve, even though that love always seems to go one way lately. Well, with so many men and women willing to put their lives on the line every day, the least we can do is make sure they are protected as well as they can be with the proper gear, including bulletproof vests. InvestUSA is one charitable organization that donates bulletproof vests to police, including to the police officers who recently rescued pilot Mark Jenkins, as well as to fellow police officer Jackie Ravello, who donated one of her kidneys to give a young girl a second chance at life. Finally, we can back our police officers when they are unduly given bad press. It doesn't mean we have to accept everything that police do as flawless. They are human, after all, but if we are willing to chastise them publicly, we should praise them at least as loudly. And just so you know, Jim Rodda, the author, is an award-winning former reporter who lives in Pennsylvania, in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. He works as a freelance writer with a specialty in history. His articles have appeared in more than 130 national and regional publications, and we're proud to carry his article on the Yonkers Tribune website. Very, very pertinent, to say the least. Now, let's look at some other things here. One second. This is really quite important as well. Fractured court, meaning the Supreme Court, blocks vaccine or test requirements for large workplaces. but green lights vaccine mandate for healthcare workers. This is written by Amy Howe. Well, with COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations reaching a new record high as a result of the Omicron variant, the Supreme Court, this is on the 13th of January, put the Biden administration's vaccine attest employers on hold over its legality continues in the lower courts. Over a dissent from the court's three liberal justices, the court ruled that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration exceeded its power in issuing the mandate. Congress may have given OSHA the power to regulate workplace dangers, the court explained, but it, quote, has not given that agency the power to regulate public health more broadly, end quote. At the same time, the justices, by a vote of 5-4, granted the administration's request to be allowed to temporarily enforce a vaccine mandate for healthcare workers at facilities that receive federal funding. Well, the orders that the justices issued on Thursday afternoon were the latest chapter in the fast-moving vaccine disputes. After the case came to the Supreme Court in December on an emergency basis, the justices opted to expedite the cases for oral argument on whether the mandates can remain in place while the challenges proceed in the lower courts. The court heard nearly 4 hours of argument on the policies on January 7 and issued a pair of unsigned opinions just 6 days later. OSHA issued the vaccine or test mandate at the Center of National Federation of Independent Business versus Department of Labor in November. It required all employers with 100 or more employees, roughly two-thirds of the private sector, to compel those employees to either be fully vaccinated during COVID-19 or to be tested weekly and wear masks at work. The government expected the mandates to cover 84 million workers. Well, businesses, states, and nonprofits went to court to challenge the mandate, and the Supreme Court today granted their request to put it on hold, describing the mandate as a, quote, significant encroachment into the lives and health of a vast number of employees, end quote. The court emphasized that Congress must speak clearly if it intends to give a federal agency the authority to, quote, exercise powers of vast economic and political significance, end quote. In this case, the court continued, Congress did not. It gave the Department of Labor the power to establish safety standards for the workplace rather than, quote, broad public health measures, end quote. Although COVID-19, quote, is a risk that occurs in many workplaces, end quote, the court acknowledged it isn't a risk that workers encounter simply by virtue of being at work. COVID-19 spreads virtually anywhere that people gather, quote, permitting OSHA to regulate the hazards of daily life. Simply because most Americans have jobs and face those same risks while on the clock would significantly expand OSHA's regulatory authority without clear congressional authorization, end quote. The court concluded that, and indeed the court noted that the fact that OSHA has never adopted a similar regulation is a, quote, telling indication, end quote, that the vaccine or test mandate exceeds the agency's power. Briefly, to each side's description of the effects of the policy, the challengers, the court observed, contended that the mandate would cost the states and employers billions of dollars and would prompt hundreds of thousands of employees to quit. The Biden administration, on the other hand, argued that the mandate would, quote, save over 6,500 lives and prevent hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations, end quote. But in the end, the court posited other government actors who are politically accountable must, quote, weigh such trade-offs, end quote, rather than the justices. Well, Justice Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan penned a rare joint dissent in which they complained that employees, quote, more than any others, end quote, have, quote, little control and therefore little capacity to mitigate risk, end quote, from the spread of COVID-19. The majority's rule, they contended, quote, stymies the federal government's ability to counter the unparalleled threat that COVID-19 poses to our nation's workers, end quote. The dissenters tackled the same question that was at the heart of a concurring opinion filed by Justice Neil Gorsuch and joined by Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. Who should decide how to respond to the pandemic? For Gorsuch, the answer is clear, quote unquote, the states and Congress. The dissenters reached a very different conclusion. OSHA, with its expertise in workplace safety and its status as a politically accountable government agency, is better suited to make decisions about how to protect workers from COVID-19 than, quote, a court lacking any knowledge of how to safeguard workplaces and insulated from responsibility for any damage it causes, end quote. Now, the vaccine or test mandate will remain on hold while the challenges to its legality continue in the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth District. Well, let's look at the health care vaccine case. In Biden versus Missouri, the justices agreed to allow the Biden administration to enforce nationwide a rule all health workers at facilities that participate in the Medicare and Medicaid programs to be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 unless they qualify for a medical or religious exemption. The Department of Health and Human Resources and Human Services issued the rule, which applies to more than 10 million workers, in November, but two federal district courts in Missouri and Louisiana put the rule on hold in roughly half the states. In an unsigned opinion, the court emphasized that a key responsibility of the Department of Health and Human Services is, quote, to ensure that the health care providers who care for Medicare and Medicaid patients protect their patients, quote, their patients' health and safety, end quote. And to do so, the Health and Human Services has long required those providers to comply with a variety of conditions if they want to receive Medicare and Medicaid funding. Because COVID-19, quote, is a highly contagious, dangerous, and especially for Medicare and Medicaid patients, deadly disease, end quote, HHS determined that a vaccine mandate was necessary to protect patients because it would decrease the chances that healthcare workers would both contract the virus and pass it on to their patients. Such a mandate, the court wrote, quote, fits nearly within, end quote, the power given to HHS by Congress. Justice Clarence Thomas filed a dissenting opinion that was joined by Alito, Gorsuch, and Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Thomas complained that the Biden administration, quote, proposes to find virtually unlimited vaccination power over millions of healthcare workers in, quote, what he described as a hodgepodge of statutes in definitional provisions, a saving clause, and a provision regarding long-term care facilities, sanitation procedures, end quote. Well, the Biden administration had not adequately explained, as far as Thomas was concerned, why Congress would have given HHS such power in relatively minor provisions. And indeed, Thomas noted if Congress had wanted to give HHS the power to impose a vaccine mandate, quote, would have done what it has done elsewhere, specifically authorized to one. So this article was originally published by Howe at the court, and so you need to know that. Now, let's just quickly look at some other things here. 1 second. I think I have time for this. No, I think I already read this to you already. So let me just move on to something else. Bear with me a second here. 1 second. Okay. This is really interesting because we normally don't hear about it. It's endometriosis, a disorder that affects 10% of women. And I don't know if we can read this to you today. Just so you know, endometriosis is a gynecological condition that affects about 10% of women. The symptoms can vary, with some women asymptomatic and others very badly affected with very severe pelvic pains. So don't think we have enough time to broach this. I don't think there's enough time here. Let me just quickly look. Bear with me a moment here. No, we won't be able to. It's too long. And 1 second. So we'll cover, let me see if there's something else we can cover within the time frame we have. Because we've only got about 5 minutes. And maybe just at the end. This is really frightening. 3 are dead in the United Arab Emirates suspected drone attack, and the Yemeni Houthis claimed the attack. Absolutely frightening. 3 people were killed in a suspected drone attack that set off a blast and a fire in Abu Dhabi on Monday, officials said, as Yemen's rebels announced military operations in the United Arab Republic, in the United Arab Emirates. Very, very frightening. It's just amazing why Yemen would want to attack the United Arab Emirates. Just insane. These people are nuts. You know, they can't talk. I don't know what the problem is. Unbelievable. Okay. Well, I think that's about it. We don't have anything else to talk to you about. Of course, today is Martin Luther King Day, and he's an icon, of course, and yet while at the same time he's an icon from the past, voting rights are under a threat here in the United States. So something to think about, and we'll try to cover more of that stuff. And just so you know, Ukraine's former president, Poroshenko, arrived in Kiev to face treason charges, but, you know, he certainly comes at a really weird time, just when the Russians want to supposedly invade Ukraine. This would be an absolute atrocity, and Poroshenko is blaming the present president of Ukraine as if he caused a lot of these issues and problems, which I don't think is the case. And besides, the present president was voted into office by a majority of people because they were disgusted by Poroshenko's leadership. So that's something to be recognized as well. Anyway, so that's the whole issue. And that's it. We'll talk to you tomorrow. I'm not even quite sure who's on tomorrow. Let me see if I could find out before our time slot's over. All right, let me just quickly see. Okay, let me just see if I can get this here. Tomorrow's Tuesday. Oh, yeah, tomorrow we're going to speak to Jeff Schwartz and Brendan Beery from CMU Cooley College, the law department professors, and then Michael Letts from Visit USA, Vest USA, and then we'll speak to Bob Marone from Westchester Radio. So hopefully you'll join us then. Take care and goodbye.